You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Costa. I'm the executive director of the International Spy Museum. Thank you for joining me in a conversation today. Welcome to the International Spy Museum. Today, I'm joined by Bryant Neal Vinas and Mitch Silber. They join me here today to talk about terrorism and to talk specifically about Bryant Neal Vinas's journey. I think it's a fascinating and compelling story. Bryant was convicted on terrorism-related charges for joining Al-Qaeda and has since been released from prison. And Mitch Silber is the former director of intelligence and analysis at NYPD, widely known for his commentary on terrorism and his analytical work. I first met Bryant in June 2012. I talked to you about your ideological journey that took you to Pakistan and Afghanistan. At that time, I watched a CNN segment about you, and before meeting you, I had read Omar Nasiri's book, Inside the Jihad, which you talked about earlier today.
Yes.
I heard it was your blueprint for waging jihad, or at least attempting to make the journey to wage jihad, and I think that's a very strong narrative as well. Today, I want to have a conversation about your radicalization and the journey you took. Thank you very much for joining me in this podcast. It's truly good to see you again, Brian.
Same here. It's great to see you, too.
Thank you. Before we get started, the final introductory point I want to make is to tell you that during my time as a special assistant to the President for Counterterrorism at the National Security Council White House last year, I reflected back on our interview, and I wanted you to know that you provided me very important context on understanding the radicalization process to help inform our counterterrorism policy choices, and I was very grateful for that. So, Brian, I'd really like you to tell your story, but before we do that, I really want to hear from Mitch because he does a very good framing. So, Mitch, welcome. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
So if you could kind of frame just your relationship, what's your connection now to Bryant, and also talk a little bit about your nonprofit because I think it's very important work.
Okay, great. Well, as Chris, you mentioned, I'm the former director of intelligence analysis at the NYPD. And after 9/11, the New York City Police Department set up its own independent intelligence collection and analysis capability that complemented the work that the Joint Terrorism Task Force did in New York City. We had a number of investigations open that were our own autonomous investigations. And in 2007, we were very much seized with the homegrown threat. Would Americans radicalize to Al-Qaeda-inspired violence and look to commit that violence on the home front? A lot of our concern in New York City was informed by what we were seeing in Europe, whether it was the attacks in Madrid, the attacks in London of 2005, other Dutch, Belgian, Germans who were seeking to travel overseas to fight for Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And the question was, would that happen in the United States? So we had a number of investigations open, and either at the end of 2007 or early 2008, intelligence was passed the NYPD that there was an American overseas, there was an American who had joined Al-Qaeda, and ultimately it was determined that that American was in fact a New Yorker, was Bryant Neal Vinyas. Bryant Neal Vinyas came from Long Island, and in New York City, the NYPD did have connections with law enforcement on Long Island, was investigating groups that had connections to Long Island. And in fact, once we knew that it was Bryant who was overseas, we in fact realized that he was connected to an individual who was a member of a group called the Islamic Thinker Societies, upon which we had an open investigation. Our concern was that Bryant was overseas. He was likely receiving training in terrorist tactics and operations, and he might well be in communication with this cluster of individuals in New York City, and they may seek to carry out some attack. There had been other Westerners who had gone to travel to visit Al-Qaeda to fight on the battlefield there, yet were turned around to carry out attacks at home in London, two different plots in Denmark and Germany. So we were also concerned that Bryant might be sent home because he knew New York City, because he was a U.S. citizen, because to some degree he had been a clean skin and might look to carry out an attack in New York. So over the better part of a year, investigations were ongoing, both JTTF and NYPD Intelligence Division, to try and ascertain what was the situation vis-a-vis Bryant and the New Yorkers who he knew. And then ultimately in November 2008, he was arrested in Peshawar, and that shifted the investigation to a new phase.
Thanks, Mitch. That's a great laydown. I appreciate that. So, Brian, tell me the story. I know you've told it before.
Yeah.
But if you can, give us your narrative again, then I have a few questions for you. It's a fascinating story.
Sure. So I guess my journey into Islam and then eventually going overseas started when I was in high school. I had gone with some friends to the mall, and I saw a pretty girl working at the kiosk selling T-shirts. So I was talking to her, flirting with her. We had good chemistry, and then I asked her if she wanted to get something to eat with me. And then she said, sorry, I can't be, I'm Muslim. If my parents find out that I'm going out on dates or if I have a boyfriend, then I can get kicked out of the house. So that piqued my curiosity to find out more about what she was telling me. So I had a friend in school explain to me that it's better to not to have a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. It's better to have a husband-wife relationship, because what if she gets pregnant? And, you know, some of the stuff that he was telling me made sense. So then I had a Turkish friend that I was a little more closer with, and I kept asking him for, you know, different questions on Islam. And I think I was bothering him after a few days of pestering him. So he offered to give me a book. It was a book on fundamental Islam, the daily prayers, a biography of the Prophet. And he gave it to me as a gift, and I read it, and I really enjoyed that book. And I was probably going to become Muslim until 9/11 happened, then I held off on it. But over the years, I still fasted during Ramadan, incorrectly, because I was still drinking water. I didn't know you couldn't have food or drink,
right.
But I was just being hungry all day. That's all I was really doing. And then from the reading of the book he gave me, it said you had to give a charity before the end of Ramadan for your fast to be accepted. So the only mosque that I knew of was in Astoria, Queens, and I walked by there many times. So I went there to make a donation. I had my checkbook ready, and I asked a young guy that was in the lobby area if he knew the name of the mosque so that I could write out a donation for him. So he says, hold on a second, let me see what I can find out for you. Goes behind the door, comes back a minute later, and he says, come on in, some guys want to talk to you. So when I go in, there's a bunch of guys sitting in a circle. One of them has a book, and one of the guys says to me, do you want to become Muslim? And I'm like, yes. So he says some stuff in Arabic for me to repeat, and I repeated him. And then he says, now you're Muslim. And I said, in my mind, I was thinking, well, I didn't want to be Muslim right there at that second.
Right.
I wanted to be Muslim eventually. So that was the story of how I embraced Islam.
Surprised that after it's the Shahada.
Yeah, it's Shahada. And I didn't know it was that easy. I didn't know it was that fast. And I didn't know it was at that moment I was going to be Muslim. I wasn't planning it that day, but that's how it ended up.
You were on that path, though.
Yeah, I was leaning towards becoming Muslim. Just wasn't planning it that day.
Right.
Yeah. So over time, I had a friend who would talk to me about conspiracy theories going on around the world. And I started researching some of these conspiracy theories about secret societies, different reasons of why there's military operations going around
Baby,
the world.
Maybe it's cold outside. Wasn't that one of the videos that you went to?
Yeah, that's one of the videos that I saw. Right. That's actually a BBC documentary.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I started researching stuff on Anwar al-Awlaki, watching jihadi videos on YouTube when YouTube was still unregulated. And you know, because before they used to put on a jihadi video and it used to be on for weeks before they would take it off. So so after some time, I had a disagreement with a friend who was in the military. And me and him, we were going back and forth. And he said to me, you know, you're like a lot of people where they just complain about stuff and never do anything about something that they feel is wrong. So that was like the last turning point that I needed to make my decision to go overseas and try to do something about it. So I knew a friend who knew some people in Pakistan that I would go and use that as my starting point. I would try to figure out how to cross over into Afghanistan and join a militant group. I had a book that I bought called Inside the Jihad by Omar Nasiri.
Right.
And I used that kind of as a template, to maybe like a guideline, so that I could follow to figure out how to end up in Afghanistan from Pakistan. I eventually joined one group that was connected with the ISI. That's the Pakistani CIA. And then I had to escape that group, bounced around a little bit, and eventually I ended up in Al-Qaeda. And I was arrested in November of 08 in Peshawar, and I was extradited back to the United States. I pled guilty to three charges, conspiracy to murder, providing material support to a terrorist organization, and receiving training from a terrorist organization. I did a total of 8 years and 8 months, and I was released out of prison. And eventually I made my way here to see you, Chris. So.
And what was the advice that, or what did the judge encourage you to do? You shared it earlier, to live your life, right? And live it well, right?
Yeah, my judge said he was cautiously optimistic, because he felt that I deserved a second chance at life. And,
second chance.
And, you know, I'm very appreciative of him giving me that chance. A lot of people didn't want to give me a second chance, but he didn't factor that in. He chose on his own to give me a second chance at life, and I don't want to disappoint him. So
I think a couple questions to ask, but you were somewhat disillusioned in some ways. You have shared in the past that you felt a little manipulated, and I think there's value in hearing your story and understanding that it wasn't what the Al-Qaeda suggested they would be. In other words, there was the Al-Qaeda that's idealized, that people thought, you know, bright and shiny, and then when you get there, it was in some cases boring. In other cases, you felt like you were being used. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that is fair to say. In the videos they make it, they paint it as a very beautiful place to be, and things are great, and it's a beautiful path to go down and get martyred. But when you go there, there's a lot of obstacles that are in your way. A lot of times they just don't want to help you join the battlefield. They make you take courses that aren't necessary to join the battlefield. And you're just doing a lot of nothing. You're killing time day after day. A lot of guys are frustrated. A lot of guys leave and they join other groups. And there's a lot of false advertisement that goes into these propaganda videos.
And to be clear, you didn't intend to join Al-Qaeda. You had intended to be an insurgent, you had intended to join the Taliban to wage your version of a jihad. Can you talk a little bit about that? And the second part of that is you had shared with me a couple years ago or several years ago that, you know, you were animated by the Palestinian problem and you wanted to wage your jihad in Afghanistan because you knew you could get to Afghanistan.
Yeah, so when I first wanted to do jihad, I didn't know anybody to get me into Palestine. I didn't know anybody to get me into Iraq. But I did know somebody that can kind of get me as a starting point in Pakistan. From there, I would work my way into Afghanistan to, you know, do jihad there. Now, I wasn't planning to go into Al-Qaeda. I thought that I would probably join a local Taliban group because there's so much Taliban groups out there. And I thought that that would be the most likely scenario for me. Once I was in Al-Qaeda, I didn't know it was Al-Qaeda. I actually asked a Kuwaiti friend of mine. I said, what group is this? Because there are many Arab, you know, smaller groups. And then he told me, this is Al-Qaeda. And I said, this is Al-Qaeda, really? And like, this is not what you see in the videos. You know, they have people training, you know, crawling on the barbed wire. They have hooded masks on all the time. Right. And it's not like that when I was there. So it was a little surprising, but... You know, once I was in, I was in. I was like, all right, well, this is it.
So, bit of a bait and switch, right?
A little bit, yeah.
We'll be right back after this.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. To learn why enterprises choose Sixth Sense, visit sixthsense.com.
So let's go back for a second because a lot of folks listening are going to be interested. I want to go back to the radicalization process because, you know, you talked about your aim and it was to wage jihad in Afghanistan.
Yes.
But dial it back a little bit. As you were going through the process, you were a seeker. And I had told you that when we first met, you were seeking something.
Yes.
And you found it in Islam. But that doesn't explain that radicalization because a lot of folks find religion fine. I remember the story that you just shared a few minutes ago about wanting to take action.
Yeah.
And you were angry, I think, about what you saw happening in Afghanistan. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but can you talk a little bit more? What was the trigger? And I know you listened to Alaki, and some of his message resonated with you. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. You know, Alaki is very influential, has inspired a lot of guys to go overseas to participate in jihadi activities. I think with his recordings, at least in the beginning, if you're pro-jihad and you listen to it, you believe that he's pro-jihadi in a lot of his recordings because he's right on the border of his messaging. And depending on what interpretation, you know, you have internally, you might interpret it as either pro-jihadi or anti-jihadi or just normal. And later on, after he came out of prison in Yemen, then it was clear that he was pro-jihadi. But before that, he wasn't very clear on that. He's very charismatic, very funny, spoke English and Arabic perfectly. Was very resourceful, naming different hadith or different Quran verses when he was giving his speeches. So he's very mesmerizing to listen to.
Persuasive.
Very persuasive, yes.
Were there any other individuals that, I don't mean... people locally, but online, were there any other characters that had a message that resonated with you? I think Bilal Phillips was one that came to mind.
Yeah, he was a very influential as far as following the Salafi sect. And even though he never said anything specific about jihad, most Al-Qaeda, most pro-jihadi groups follow Salafism. So if you're learning about Salafism, you're obviously going to be learning about jihad, and
right.
you're going to be learning about these other groups. So even though he never said anything specific about those groups or jihad, learning about Al-Qaeda goes hand in hand with learning about Salafism.
And you had done some study, because I remember you and I talked about Qutb, right? You studied milestones, or you were familiar with milestones, is
a
that fair
bit,
to
yeah.
say?
Yes, right. yes.
That, I mean,
that
not
comes
deeply,
from,
right?
Yeah, it comes from the Baby It's Cold documentary where they talk about Sayyid Qutb. And that made me curious to read his book. I read his book. It's very difficult to read.
You read Milestones?
Yeah, I read Milestones.
That's impressive. Yeah.
And really, only one chapter is specifically about jihad. The rest is more theoretical. Milestones is almost like a must read for people in the Arab world that want to do jihad. So I read it in the English version.
No, I remember that. I recall that. And I'm yeah. impressed that you read Milestones.
It's a tough read.
I understand that.
It's a tough read.
The other story I would like you to retell just briefly.
Sure.
Because I remember thinking the fact that you went to Cuba,
yeah.
you know, that said a lot about you, about, yeah. you know, a sense of adventurism, however you want to define it. Mm-hmm. But you did something that the average American wouldn't do. And this is before you decided, evidently, or as I understand it, to go to wage jihad. So that mm-hmm. fascinated me. Just tell that story about how you got Cuba while you were boxing.
Sure. So because I started boxing later in life, not when I was a little child like a lot of great boxers do, in order to speed up the learning process for me, I decided to go to Cuba. It's a great place to go to train for boxing. You can get a really great trainer and pay him, you know, a pretty good cheap wage, and he, for them, it's great money. And it's affordable for me to speed up the learning process. And I had one-on-one coaching for a while. And the only thing I could say is that it made me better at learning how to figure out how to go somewhere. But other than that, there really is no connection between Pakistan and Cuba. Just my
own
personal...
What about the discipline? You've mm-hmm. alluded to that in the past as well, mm-hmm. as far as your self-discipline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the training is very rigorous. Before I hurt my back, I was... training like an animal.
Right.
And
how is your back, by the way?
My back is terrible right now.
Terrible.
I have three herniated discs right now.
All right.
It went from 2 to 3 now. So, but I was in great shape. That was probably the best shape I ever was in my life. And you know, the discipline of going training every day,
right?
Putting in the hard work. You know, it paid off, but like I said, I hurt my back, so that's as far as I went.
So I don't think I'm jumping around when I ask mm-hmm. you back to Islam for a second. Mm-hmm. You, one of the appeals, as I recall, you talked about Islam provided prescriptions for living
yes.
and diet. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that had an appeal as well for you, correct?
Yes, in the book that my friend gave me, it talked about staying away from intoxicants, like, for example, like alcohol and pork. How to carry yourself a certain way, how to respect others, how to treat your body correctly. And that really hit a soft spot in my heart because, you know, a lot of other religions don't really talk about it that much, but this one was emphasized that a lot, and it's something that attracted me a lot to Islam.
Thanks. That explains a lot. You told me also how you self-identify, how you view yourself. You had told me you thought you were a failed warrior when we last talked. Can you describe, you know, how you arrived at that conclusion? I mean, you failed because you failed to get into Afghanistan to wage jihad because you were rolled up by authorities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I went with a goal to be martyred on the battlefield. Never happened. I mean, I tried best I could, but other people... just didn't either want me to go or they were making it difficult for me to go, and I failed in that aspect. And you know, You know, but now that I look back and hindsight, you know, I'm here now. It gives me an opportunity to take what I did and turn it into something good. And even though I failed in one category, I hope to be successful in another category, which is, you know, helping out the counterterrorism field. So
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but that's exactly right. There's a huge value in having you tell your story, I think, and deterring others maybe to go down that path. The other question, I think I know the answer to this, but I like the way you answer this.
Sure.
Why didn't you just stay in New York and do what something like SAPOF did last year in New York City, or conduct some act of terrorism in New York? You explained that partially, but you could have stayed at home. And Al-Qaeda has asked jihadists to stay at home and attack at home. Why didn't you do that?
Well, I wanted to be martyred on the battlefield. I thought the war zone in Afghanistan was a legitimate one at the time. I felt that if I wanted to do something here, I could have just stayed here and did it. I think it was better off to go and in anonymity, you know, go and as a regular soldier just like everybody else and die, and then didn't turn out that way. But
didn't you tell me Alaki had a message on that appealed to you at the time, being martyred on the battlefield and buried in an unmarked grave?
Yes, if you die and nobody knows, you know, that you died out there, you just were just killed in combat and you were buried as a, you know, just another fighter out there, that was something very honorable. Something that's very rewarding in the afterlife if that's how you ended your life. And that's one of the goals I wish I would have accomplished at the time. So that was very appealing to me. Yes.
So now here you are. You've gone through many changes.
Yes.
You're out of custody, and you're giving back by telling your story. And I think there's some value in that. So where are you right now? Are you doing okay?
Yeah, I'm hanging in there. You know, I'm working with Mitch. We've worked on an article for the West Point Academy's newsletter on the Sentinel.
Yeah, I heard about that today, and I apologize. I didn't know it was published already.
No, it's all
right. So I am going to chase that thing down probably tonight, so I look forward to reading it.
Yeah, and, you know, I went to West Point, and I educated some of their professors on jihadism, gave them a better understanding. I was out in two other speaking engagements earlier today, educating people on jihadism and answering questions about my story the best I could, my life story the best I could. I'm here with you, you know, in the Spy Museum. It's a quirky, funny place to be in. I love being here. And, you know, helping you educate jihadism to your listeners. So.
No, that's exactly right. Now, our listeners know that our mission significantly is to inform the public, to educate the public, and we have a variety of programs. You've literally not been the first former terrorist to come to speak to us. I just spent some time with another one recently, and there's such value in humanizing the process that you went through, because you had a good outcome. So I'll ask you again. I know you're not a policymaker, nor am I, right? We're neutral here, but what's your advice on CVE, countering violent extremism? Because I should say that recently I had Nick Rasmussen here. Okay. Nick and I worked together at the White House. Mitch, you know Nick. He was head of the National Counterterrorism Center. And both of us recognized that we both agreed that we didn't make enough progress on CVE. So that was a frank admission on our part. Any advice to policymakers, the value of outreach and CVE programs? We talked a little bit about it, but now is your opportunity to share your perspectives.
Yeah, I think everybody who is in my situation should be looked at individually. I don't think everybody should be grouped under one category.
Not one size fits all. Right?
Yeah, not one size fits all. That's a very good way of describing it. And there are some people that want to turn their life around, and if they're available to educate people on jihadism or their experiences in other fields, that they should be listened to. Now, whether they take their advice or not, that's something different, but they should at least be listened to. And some are crazy and that they should be ignored. And, you know, you just make a record of what they say and just keep on moving. But as far as countering violent extremism, I think having people who experience the other side of the world can help educate people who are possibly going down that path to try to dissuade them into following the same mistakes that I did or other people have made. And I think that'd be a great starting point.
Well said, Brian. Thank you very much. Mitch, do you have any thoughts? We've covered a lot of ground. I know you guys came a long way to do the podcast and do a couple other engagements today. So it's been a long day. Any other thoughts that you might have?
You know, I would just add to Brian's comments in response to your CVE question. You know, I think that the way we have to look at this problem, this is not about hugging a terrorist, right? This is about, ultimately, it's a national security question, keeping all of us safer. You know, individuals who have spent time in prison, served their time, repented, you know, more could and should be done to help them reintegrate into society. One, because it's a good moral thing to do, they've served their time. But number two, out of self-interest. We don't want former terrorists to be recidivists, because that means that they're terrorist action. Number two, I think, you know, targeted interventions like Brian was alluded to. If you've got someone who's been on that other side of the world, been there, done that, and is disillusioned, what a great resource to be able to apply to an 18, 19, 20-year-old version of yourself who's going down that road, and maybe it's with, you know, federal agents, prosecutor's office, nonprofit, but have an intervention and say, hey, listen, I've been there. You don't want to go down that road. That's a dead end. And it's not like the videos show. You know, so I think that's an important way you could use CVE. And then you get into sort of the broader, what they call PVE, preventing violent extremism, educational, you know, really more at the grassroots level. I think in some ways that's the trickiest, because it's sort of not precisely targeted. You're trying to hit a wide audience. But, you know, maybe you start with, you know, formers who are coming out of prison, work with targeted interventions and figure out what works, and then maybe bring that to the preventing violent extremism. But it's an area that the U.S. is way behind Europe and other countries on.
Well, that's a good articulation. I agree with most of what you said. In fact, all of it. I mean, we just need to do a better job of counter-radicalization, counter-messaging, really. And I think if there are gaps, I think there have been significant debates in the interagency, and we'll get to the right, at some point, we'll get to the right place. It's, in some ways, it's been very experimental. So we'll see where it goes, but I think this really helps, and this validates what I talked about last year. So it's a pleasure again seeing you, Brian, and I have a feeling we'll see each other again.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page.